Hello, everybody. Welcome to a very special episode of, well, I guess since you're listening to this on Tuesday, it would be a very special episode of Sights and Sounds of Cinema. But it's also a very special episode of Objection, the worldwide leader in contrarian a-holery. So, yes, this is a hyper gimmicky crossover episode, but you know what? We're pretty excited about it. So let's introduce the cast here. I am Judge David Johnson, Judge Dan Mancini from the Objection side of things.
Yes, greetings.
And Judge Clark Douglas from the Sights and Sounds. Clark, how are you?
I'm doing well, sir, and yourself?
Not too bad. Thanks for letting us hitch a ride on your wonderful program.
We appreciate and that. Likewise, thank you for letting me jump on board the explosive Objection train.
It's explosive. So what we had decided, and Clark, we had done a Friday Filibuster crossover at some point, right? A while
yes,
ago?
We did. I'm trying to remember. I think it was just everybody talking about their favorite film scores.
I think so. It was pretty random. So we decided to narrow it down a little more. And this kind of what passes for show prep for me and Dan, but we pretty much sent a Facebook message to each other, and we thought it would be fun to talk about some of our favorite themes and get into the nuts and bolts of what makes a good theme for diehard knockoff movies.
Yeah. Which shows that we're like struggling now to find ways to work diehard knockoffs into shows.
Yes, and like he said in death, but
every possible angle that we can do to talk about diehard knockoffs makes us happy, clearly.
So, so Clark, we're probably bringing down the cultured and refined, you know, the refinement of your show a few degrees here, but we appreciate you joining us for it.
No, absolutely not. It's a delight to be doing this.
Nice. Well, before we get rolling on that, I wanted to connect with you guys. Dan, I saw you were watching 13 Assassins. I just polished off the review for my Blu-ray. And Clark, you haven't seen that yet, correct?
I haven't, but I've heard nothing but great things about it, and I've been very much looking forward to it.
Nice. Well, I thought we could maybe talk briefly about it. And Dan, I just want to say right off the gate that as it stands right now, 13 Assassins is my favorite movie of 2011 and the best one, I think, objectively the best one of 2011.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I'm hoping that Captain America will eclipse it, because then Captain America will be utterly fantastic. But we'll see. If not, you know, we still have 12 Assassins. And like I posted on Facebook today, because I'm reviewing the DVD, I love the movie so much that I bought the Blu-ray today. Because it just wasn't good enough to own.
Yeah, it wasn't sent
only
to
the
us
DVD.
It wasn't sent to us to review, so... You know, I told Michael I'll review it on my dime because I was going to own it anyway. And the Blu-ray, by the way, is perfect scores for me as far as visual and audio.
Fantastic. Absolutely. It is great. And, you know, I got to say, in terms of Mike, I have pretty much hated everything he's done prior to this.
It's not a Mike film. It doesn't.
This is how awesome it is. I mean, I hate Ichi the Killer. I absolutely hate that movie. I gave Sukiyaki Western Django a bad review on the site and have gotten, you know, quite a bit of negative feedback as a result. I just have typically not liked anything that he's done. He's just too self-aware and kind of visually garish most of the time. But man, 13 Assassins is great. It's restrained in a lot of ways, although there's a very long action sequence at the end.
Even though it's 50 minutes long. And like, actually, we'll pause there for a second. Clark, do you know the basic plot of the film? Do you know, like, sort of what's going on?
Yeah, I know the basic outline. Yeah.
I mean, it's a familiar kind of thematic approach. You know, it's a small group of elite fighters against overwhelming odds. You know, kind of a suicide mission, or like a Dirty Dozen type of approach, right? Or
sure,
right. You know, I mean, you know, even. So, you know, it's a very familiar type of
the
theme.
The Men on a Mission movie.
Men on a Mission, absolutely. Laying down their lives for a greater cause. But it's got so many. In my review, I just noted how it's like it's traditional and orthodox in that sense. Yet it still is like it still resonates like to me uniquely and freshly the way Miike approaches it. So
you know,
it's epic and it's intimate. You know, it's action-packed, yet it's also – it takes its time building and you get invested in it. So, I mean, I know I sound like hyperbole boy here, but really, from start
to
finish,
yeah.
I just thought he nailed it completely. Yeah, and there – balls there on
are,
this thing.
Yeah, and there are touches of his kind of grotesque style that you see in his other movies.
Yeah, but very –
they're like very controlled and they're in the right context in this movie. So they really work. They have like – an actual emotional power to them.
And the one thing I know you're
typical, like, oh, you know,
the female victim scene, correct?
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
But I agree with you completely. In fact, we talk about restraint, and you know, the other thing, Clark, too, is this movie is really renowned for. It's a 2-hour movie, and the second hour is literally nonstop action, and that's that's not being, you know, I'm not, again, it's not hyperbole. I mean, I looked at my timer when I was watching it on the Blu-ray, you know, and when hour two clicks in, it is just sustained action, and it's remarkable, and it's engrossing action too.
And it's a really like deliberately paced first hour,
right? Absolutely, you
know? And it takes its time. It sets up the character as well and everything. And so
it gives
the
you
action
villain.
Is really grounded in the characters too. It's,
yeah. So you're invested in it, you know? So obviously there's going to be a high mortality rate, but that's impactful. And like the cause they're fighting for is worthwhile because the villain is one of the most detestable and loathsome I've ever seen. You know, the Lord, Nariagochi or something. Terrible. I mean, terrible guys. So, everything worked, and it's just, and it's beautifully shot. Like all the traditions of samurai films are just present here. It is restrained. I mean, to me, talking about restrained, I mean, there's a scene where a samurai is on fire and he gets cut in half with a sword, and it's still restrained. I don't know how you restrain it, but he did it. So it's not like this gratuitous limb hacking. You know, the violence is earned. You know, you're not going to park a 4-year-old in front of it, but it's not like Peter Jackson dead alive over the top craziness.
Well, and Dan, going back to something you said a few minutes ago, one of the encouraging things that I did hear about it was that it basically wasn't a traditional Miike film because his movies really haven't done much for me either.
Yeah.
And so when I saw he was the director, I was kind of like, all right. But everything I've read thus far seems to indicate that this is a dramatically different sort of film for him.
Yeah, to me, it's a much more mature work than most of what he's done thematically and stuff. It's a movie that seems to make fairly overt reference without overdoing it or being too self-conscious to like the 47 Ronin story, which has been made into movies many, many times in Japan, as well as Seven Samurai. I mean, it has some obvious connections to those movies. And it, you know, I think Miike is aware of that in putting the movie together, but he doesn't make it, you know, it's not like some Quentin Tarantino thing where it's like, oh, look, I'm making reference to Seven Samurai here kind of thing. He just sort of lets it play out like, yes, these are the archetypes, sort of like an American director making a Western.
But it's his own movie.
You can
self-consciously
reference, you know, Stagecoach or something, or you can just recognize these are the archetypes of the genre and I'm going to use them just like the other movies did, and it's going to bring those movies up in the viewer's mind, but I'm not going to overplay it.
Right, because the characters are the characters, and the story is the story, and it's, you know, it stands apart like that. So it doesn't need those callbacks. It doesn't need those references. So it operates within those archetypes, like you had said, Dan, but, I mean, as its own story with its own set of characters, it really is remarkable the way it's staged. So.
And I hope I'm not misquoting him, but I'm pretty sure I read something where Miike basically said something to the effect of, I have only just begun to make movies, and this was essentially the start of a new chapter in his cinematic career as far as he was concerned.
Well, bring it on, you know?
Be awesome, yeah, bring it, because, yeah, it's an impressive – I mean, I wish that, having mentioned Tarantino earlier, I wish he would make this kind of turn where all of a sudden he started making thematically mature pictures and stuff, and you know, I was hoping after Jackie Brown that's where we were going, and
because that seemed to be such a leap into mature territory for him, and then he backed away from that so quickly with Kill Bill and Grindhouse and so on and so forth. But at least to me, Jackie Brown remains overall his most satisfying movie.
Yeah. Oh, I love that movie, and I really haven't liked anything since. And so hopefully, you know, I mean, if this is a harbinger of things to come for
Miike, more stuff
he
could like
easily
this.
become one of my favorite filmmakers.
Yeah, I mean, it's got
one of my least favorite to one of my favorite.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it's night and day. If his name wasn't on this, would there be any? Would you know it was him? You know, no chance.
I would have thought, you know, it was like maybe Takeshi Kitano or something.
You know, it really, you know, I threw out, I mean, the Peter Jackson reference isn't too far off. You know, who thought the guy who did Meet the Feebles and bad taste would give us the Lord of the Rings trilogy, you know? So I guess it's in – some people have it in them, and if they can move past some of those things. So I don't.
Which I did. Have you picked up the extended cuts on Blu-ray?
I have not. Have you?
Yes.
And is it worth it?
I watched them. Definitely.
Okay. All right.
And I told myself I wasn't going to do it.
Because I've got them on the regular theatrical one. You know?
Right. And then I was like, you know, I'm going to go ahead. And so I sold off the theatricals.
You know, I love them dearly, but they're the movies that I know I wouldn't – I don't know if I can never sit down and put 5 hours into Return of the King, you know? We'll see.
Well, it was a very satisfying experience going through them again. And there's something – I mean, there's just so much more weight.
Yeah, that's true. I agree.
It's that, you know, but I'm kind of – you know, I'm always split because I'm kind of with you too that the – you know, the theatrical cuts are manageable in terms of – I could watch those again, but man, you know.
Well, so yeah. So anyway,
Fellowship of the Ring does look better, by the way.
What did say that again?
The Fellowship of the Ring does look
good.
Better.
All right, good. Very good. And that might be worth it in itself. Then, and I can't deny myself any more sweet orc slaying that the extended cut brings in Fellowship.
It does, yeah.
Some beautiful violence. But anyway, so yeah, so Clark really highly recommended, the highest of recommendations for 13 Assassins.
Well, I am very much looking forward to it.
I think you'll like it a great deal, and I actually look forward to what you would think of it. But I guess, I mean, that's our highbrow consensus. Well, we're not really being contrarian a-holes here, I guess.
No.
We got to be on our best behavior, and I should mention too, Clark, you can expect a nice check from the old white man cabal for having us on board here. So
wonderful.
So and can... probably a very, very expensive brandy or scotch.
Yes, that's right.
They have maybe a shaved access cap to the greatest liquor in the world.
That's right. So I guess we could just transition to really what makes our clocks tick, and those are, you know, diehard knockoffs. And we talk about these are regular topics of discussion on Objections.
Yes.
So it kind of shows you our emotional maturity level is. But before we go into knockoffs, Clark, I wanted to ask you in general the actual theme of diehard. Where, I mean, how is that even not even the action genre? Does that have any respect? You know, the actual theme of Die Hard.
Not really, honestly.
Yeah, it's recognizable, and that's about it, I think.
That is pretty much about it. The guy who wrote the music for those movies, Michael Kamen, is a talented composer, and it's decent music. But if we're really being honest, the most memorable music, and at least the first Die Hard, is Ode to Joy by far.
Yeah. Oh, right.
And even in the second movie, maybe the Christmas music makes a stronger impression.
And the third movie, what's the name of the song during the whole bank holdup?
I know the one you're talking about.
You know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
I suck at this, but yeah.
But it's decent music, but it's not particularly striking. And it is recognizable, but perhaps not instantly so. And so I don't think there's a terribly definitive template there for people to borrow from when making diehard ripoff films.
For the scores, because obviously the template.
Right, no, right. That's, I should have clarified there. But yes, the movie obviously has the template, but
that's right.
Not the music.
So we rattle off a bunch that came to our mind, some of our favorites, Dan. Obviously, Sudden Death is up there. That's brought into regular rotation. But, you know, like Cliffhanger, you know, Die Hard on a Mountain, right? And Under Siege, you got Die Hard on a Boat. Under Siege 2, Die Hard on a Train, which was just... That's a movie we actually watched back to back one night. I don't know what happened. I don't know why I did that, but so I don't know, Clark. You said you had a whole bunch of them, so I guess I'll put this out to both of you guys. Is there any Die Hard knockoff soundtrack that stands out to you? Because there could be a risk of a lot of just generic action music. But so are there any that stand out to you?
I would say the one that stands out to me the most, and this is kind of a two-part answer of sorts, but the music written for Air Force One,
mm-hmm.
It initially received a score by Randy Newman, of all people,
wow.
Which is surprisingly great stuff, a fascinating action score, some of the most ambitious stuff he had done in the world of film music, but it was thrown out and replaced by a score from Jerry Goldsmith, which is distinctive, but maybe not necessarily always in a good way, in that it pretty much has this one super patriotic theme that it just plays over and over and over again.
Now that you say it, that sounds about right.
Yeah.
That seems pretty repetitive.
But either way, probably the most easily memorable, if only through sheer force of will on Mr. Goldsmith's part.
There's a lot of, I mean, there's a lot of juice to that, because I reviewed that Blu-ray a long time ago. Because there's some pretty big action scenes, and I just remember them, and at least in the audio mix, just blasting that score out. I mean, it was like a cacophony, you know, like the jet sequences with the fighter jets and the passenger, and they're all near collisions and all that stuff, and obviously the fight scenes. I mean, I recall that being overwhelmingly, you know, the auditory influence being overwhelming.
Yeah, and in fairness to the composer, he had about 3 weeks to write that score. It was kind of a last-minute
rush. Nice.
An absurdly short amount of time to write an entire film score. And so, you know, he's like, you know what? I've got this theme. We're going to do variations on that for 2 hours, and that'll do.
Nice. How about you, Dan?
Just in terms of most memorable?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, we were joking around because you sent me the link to the YouTube clip of the Sudden Death score,
Yeah. And
that one always... I've seen that movie so many times that, yeah, that probably sticks in my head. I don't know that it's a distinctive score. It's just seeped into my brain
Do you know what's happening when you hear, can you pinpoint what's happening in the movie when you hear certain things? You know, this is the fight with the penguin mascot, you know?
Yeah, probably. Yeah.
And we should mention Clark has not seen Sudden Death. Correct.
I have not, no. I've been told I've missed a cinematic treasure, though.
You wait for the Blu-ray, which will never come out, unfortunately.
Yeah. But if it does, hopefully it will have a commentary by us. Another bit of lobbying.
That's right.
Yeah, and it's not a distinctive score, but it's a typical sort of throbbing action, you know, with heroic flourishes and stuff, but... Yeah, that's probably, you know, I mean, I can't think of a Die Hard knockoff that has a, you know, sort of, certainly not like a Raiders of the Lost Ark level, you know, memorable score.
Well, the only one for me, so one that sticks out for me, and I've seen this movie a bunch of times too, but the score to Cliffhanger.
Now,
for some reason, and Clark, you can correct me if I'm wrong. It sounds a lot like, at least there are bits of it that remind me a lot of the Last of the Mohicans score.
Right, and of course the same composer.
Is it?
Yes, Trevor Jones,
who
wrote the score for Last of the Mohicans, wrote Cliffhanger also.
Nice.
And
that honestly answers a question I've been making the last 20 years of my life or so.
Very nice.
But that score, if the actual underscore isn't too distinctive, I would at least say that it does have a memorable main theme.
Yeah, that's what it was. Yeah. Right.
Yeah. And the kind of big, brassy, expansive sounding sort of thing.
It actually fits. I mean, obviously, it is close to Last of the Mohicans. Maybe there's derivatives and stuff there, but it fits in Cliffhanger because, you know, that is like, you know, a lot of big shots of the Rocky Mountains, or it's not the Rocky Mountains, actually. I think it was filmed in the Alps, I'm pretty sure. But so big mountain shots. So that. That sweeping feel at least does seem to fit.
Yeah.
Some element. So
I don't know whatever happened to Trevor Jones, because it seemed like he was scoring so many action movies and big blockbusters in the 90s, and then he did League of Extraordinary Gentlemen and then kind of disappeared after that. I don't know if it made such a bad impression on people that they wouldn't hire him anymore, but I haven't heard much of him lately.
Like, how about some insight into the craft here? How do these guys, I mean, like, how do you get pegged to be the 80s actioner, you know, composer, or the 90s actioner composer, you know?
There are a variety of different factors there, but it's really weird how some of these things happen. Sometimes it's just, you know, getting a random assignment on one film and doing it so well that you kind of get typecast. And it happens in the oddest of places. Like, for instance, Elmer Bernstein, who... for decades was kind of the guy who scored prestigious Hollywood, you know, Oscar bait type dramas and things like that. You know, he scored like To Kill a Mockingbird, movies like that.
Mm-hmm.
He, in I think it was the early 1980s, scored Stripes, the Bill Murray.
Yeah. All right.
For the rest of the decade, he was pretty much entirely working on movies starring Saturday Night Live cast members.
Wow.
So he scored like Funny Farm and Ghostbusters and Spies Like Us and The Three Amigos and on and on and on.
Do you think he would regret taking that first gig? That solidified that typecasting?
I've wondered that sometime, but at the same time, these were, you know, reasonably well-paying projects, I would imagine. But
sure.
I'm curious to know what he thought of that, because it's kind of an amusing thing to consider.
Okay, another question for you guys. Like, what do you think a score for a movie like your Cliffhanger, like your Sudden Death, your Under Siege, these kind of this parade of terrorists taking over. So speaking of genre conventions and archetypes, these diehard knockouts, what makes a score successful? What does it have to contain, you think? Open-ended question.
For me, at the very least, I know this is just kind of a personal preference sort of thing, and some people don't like it, but I like for there to be some memorable thematic element at play, even if, you know, you're dealing with intense chaotic music, to have some kind of melody in there to play with or do variations on that gives the score some kind of identity other than just its overall orchestral, you know, design.
Yeah.
But there are some people who feel that, you know, that sort of sing-song quality to the action scores can take away from the grittiness of everything. But I don't think that's necessarily true, but some people do feel that way.
Dan, what about you? What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I would agree with that. A memorable theme on top of, you know, because these are the sorts of scores where it tends to be very rhythmic and like Sudden Death, and it just kind of throbs along, you know. So something, some kind of memorable theme, and then, you know, something villainous is kind of nice too.
Mm-hmm.
Give me something. Yeah. Give me something to attach to the bad guy to kind of underscore his douchebaggery.
You know, and I think I agree. And you know, part of what I love listening to scores of movies that I really enjoyed. I like doing that little matchup. Like, okay, this part happened in this section, which I really enjoyed, and it kind of allows me to relive that section of the film. You know, so
yeah.
So, you know, that kind of goes with what you were saying, Clark, about having an identity or something recognizable. Because, yeah, just a lot of noise and, you know, fast-moving percussion or whatever to move in the background, moving the action along is one thing. But, like, to me, it's always, you know, like, for example, and we talked about this on the Filibuster crossover, right? The Willow soundtrack, right?
Yes.
You know, I listened to that thing, you know, because it remains my favorite movie. But I watched that movie so many times. I listened to that thing over and over. But I would listen to, okay, that's during this wagon chase, you know? And it would be almost kind of that transportive type of feel. So I think even if it's in a couple of sequences, like a big action sequence, you know, like the centerpiece action sequence, if there's something recognizable there, I enjoy that just because I can connect that with my mind and kind of relive that cool moment.
Yeah.
And there's a score that can take you right back in there. That's fantastic. Which, you know, like we mentioned, John Williams scores.
Right.
Do that.
And of course his Star Wars scores are kind of the king of assigning a theme to every imaginable thing. I mean,
yeah.
I think there's literally like hundreds of Star Wars themes littered through the course of those six movies.
The Salacious Crumb March.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah, but in a more general sense too, like I think it didn't Jerry Goldsmith score Planet of the Apes?
He did.
The original. That score, that's something more. I can hear that and man, I am like instantaneously back in that movie the second that I hear that score. It's so distinctive and it's such an odd percussive thing that I'm not just back into particular scenes, but I'm back into how it feels to watch that movie and be in that world.
Yeah, and that score feels, I mean, it's got that atonal 12-tone thing going on, and it's so dramatically different from not only any other movie of the era, really, but any other blockbuster, especially. It just has such a distinctive sound. And if I'm not mistaken, I'm pretty sure that there were a few percussion instruments that Jerry Goldsmith basically invented for that score, just trying to find alien sounds, essentially, something that sounded foreign and primitive and bizarre all at once.
And but, you know, And the reverse is also kind of true, and this kind of goes back to a brief Facebook exchange we had, Clark. Like, there's an to me an instance where like the score actually outshines the film itself. Mm-hmm. It was the Tron Legacy score by Daft Punk. And like, you know, Dan and I talked about it, and I didn't hate the movie. Like, you know, I think Dan, you liked it a little more than I did. You know, I was okay with the movie.
Yeah.
But the score is just so unbelievably great, and I still listen to it over and over again. Like I couldn't tell you, like, what cues that, you know, they call back to in the film, but it's not necessary for me because, like, to me that's just a fantastic score that almost outshines the source material. I mean, the material it's attached to.
Yeah, I agree. And another example, yesterday actually, I watched the director's cut of Legend, nice. Which I hadn't seen the director's cut before, and that's got the original Jerry Goldsmith score, as opposed to the Tangerine Dream score for the theatrical version. That score really just outshines the movie in so many ways. And it's not a bad movie. I enjoy it. But the score just seems to be on another level entirely, and that does happen from time to time.
Now, speaking of, you know, composers who might get typecast or fall into one kind of genre, some more recent diehard knockoffs came from the Bruckheimer camp with like Con Air, and then The Rock, obviously, and I believe I own both of those soundtracks. I still own The Rock, and that comes in handy if I'm making, you know, videos like action videos for, you know, for work or something. But I think The Rock soundtrack is like 7 tracks, you know.
Yeah.
You know,
and it's over an hour.
Yeah, right. So it's not this huge sprawling thing, but I mean, they're not like a bunch of 1 minute, 2 minute bites, you know. So they're pretty hefty, and they end with the most divergent and recognizable score, I thought, which is the score to the huge San Francisco chase, which made zero sense in the context of the film. You know, it was completely pointless, and you know, nothing made sense in the movie. The characters' actions, nothing. And I think Michael Bay said he had to put that in there. I don't know. He was told to put that in there for something. I don't know. But either way, it showed. And I think that score and the score showed that too, because it seemed so different than everything else. But
yeah, it's got a lot more of those drum machines and that.
Yeah, yeah. But I will say though, I mean, it did the job as far as, I mean, it kind of matched the chaos that was happening on screen, mm-hmm. and it was, you know, it was enjoyable to listen to, you know, it was unceasing in its forward momentum. So that's I've always kind of liked that score. There's a lot of little different things going on. You know, I mean, it's obviously not Academy Award winning stuff, but it, to me, that's suitable. I mean, The Rock is kind of hasn't aged very well, and it's kind of disposable action fare, but I think that score suits it okay.
And I think part of the reason it really hasn't aged so well is that it's been imitated so frequently.
Yeah, good point.
I mean, I saw Transformers 3 about a week ago, and that score owes, you know, 95% of what it is to The Rock. And so many action movies, particularly the ones Bruckheimer's involved with, basically recycle The Rock score to some degree. Even Con Air does that.
Yeah, that's interesting. Mm-hmm. That you bring that up. Yeah, I think you're dead on there. I mean, can you source The Rock at all in maybe Crimson Tide too?
Yes, that was exactly what I would source it in, Crimson Tide. And then Crimson Tide, I think you could source in Black Rain, actually.
Oh, really?
Oh. But that one, I'm at a loss to source Black Rain anywhere. So I think that may be kind of the start of the – Black Rain is kind of the origin of the modern action score.
I think – did Zimmer do – did he do Broken Arrow too?
He did.
Yeah, so I think – I mean, there's some recognizable stuff there too. And another movie that has not aged well at all. It makes zero sense when you really look at it. But was kind of in that gold rush of – you know, over the top 90s actioners, you know, mm-hmm. that was a great time. Let's all be honest.
Yeah. And Broken Arrow is somewhat more distinctive than some of the others in that for whatever reason, they decided to throw some like faux Ennio Morricone stuff in there with the twangy Dwayne Eddy type guitar.
That's right. That's the John.
Yeah, that's right.
It was a John Travolta's villain.
Right. And I'm like, all right, that's cool. But I don't really know why, because I don't really get any sort of Leone vibes from that movie otherwise, but...
Well, it's the same reason why the Army only sent one helicopter to stop a nuclear bomb.
Yeah.
It didn't launch ICBMs or anything. Those are the questions we don't want to answer, I think.
Exactly. That's a don't ask why kind of movie. From top to bottom, every aspect, score included.
So, I mean, is it safe to say that... I mean, are we seeing some parallels here, whereas Die Hard maybe kind of spawned all of these, you know, all of these knockoffs, that you can source a lot of the scores that we've seen, and maybe in Bruckheimer stuff or other terrorist gone wild movies, not in the Die Hard score, but maybe in earlier versions of other movies, and those same kind of composers just built off that?
Yeah, I mean, I think in terms of modern summer blockbusters, the majority of modern film music for popcorn movies can be traced back to Hans Zimmer, basically. Because he brought a distinctive kind of European sound that was dramatically different from anything else anybody was doing at the time. And at the time felt very fresh. Now, you know, it's everywhere and has been diluted to the point that it's just become generic.
That's right.
But
and he did, I mean, didn't he work with someone to do like The Dark Knight and Batman Begins, right?
Yeah, he did. He worked on those. And, you know, so many of the major film composers working today were essentially his protégés.
Really?
John Powell, Harry Gregson-Williams, Trevor Rabin worked with him. There are quite a few others. Nick Glennie-Smith, Mark Mancina. So a lot of the people getting steady work out there today are basically Zimmer disciples.
Interesting. Yeah, The Dark Knight, for example, that's like, I mean, again, I love the movie dearly, like probably my favorite movie in, you know, Lord knows how long, but it never really, the score never jumped out at me. I mean, it's got some interesting things going on, and the Joker's theme is kind of cool, you know,
yeah,
kind of the harsh, those harsh sounds, but like that and Batman Begins never really jumped out at me, having something as recognizable as, say, like Danny Elfman's themes, you know, for his Batman movies.
Yeah, and admittedly, I mean, if you use the Danny Elfman scores in the Nolan Batman movies, the effect would probably be kind of silly. But
true.
But yeah, the Dark Knight and Batman Begins scores are a little more generic than I wish they were.
Do you think that was a stylistic choice? I know we're kind of getting off track, but
I do to an extent. And I think if you look at Christopher Nolan's movies, I would say Inception may be an exception.
I agree. Yeah.
But yeah, the music just really isn't that distinctive in most of his movies, aside from that one. I mean, The Prestige, I think, is a really good film, but the music is just maybe the most forgettable score of that year. It's kind of just sound design that sits there in the background.
If you had told me there was no score on The Prestige, I would have agreed with you.
There. You've got over an hour of music, but it doesn't do anything. It's just there.
He's definitely a minimalist. And
right.
Yeah, he's definitely a minimalist, and it's based on his movies, it's coming from him. It's not coming from...
It's got to be. Yeah, I mean, because even the big action scenes in, like, Batman Dark Knight, the music, is, you know, it services the action. Like, it's fast-moving and it pushes you along. But, like, honestly, the only thing I think of are, like, those Joker, you know, the Joker musical cues. Like, you know, I don't know what the instrument is, but, you know, when he's telling
that
story...
That whole score, it's sort of like there is that very simple heroic theme that I think is pretty effective in the movie, but the way that it is handled throughout the score, it's throttled pretty much, you know, and I get the sense that it's Nolan who's throttling it. Like, well, you know, I don't want an overstated hero theme.
Because based on his track record, you know, it's not Hans Zimmer who's pulling back there and saying, you know, I think we should be subtle.
That's right.
Right.
But yeah, I get the sense from watching his movies that he kind of likes the idea of music more as sound design, basically, than as, you know, melodies or themes accompanying characters.
Right.
Okay. Well, you know, I think this is kind of our runtime here for Objection. I feel like I got my. I feel like this has been the most productive Objection in a long time, Dan. Don't you think we squeezed out a lot of information in this half?
Yeah.
And we only mentioned like
it's amazing what
twice.
You can do when you have someone on the show who knows something.
That's right.
As opposed to us, you know.
That's right. But we do, Clark, we are going to leave you with two assignments. Watch 13 Assassins and watch Sudden Death.
Okay, I will get right on that.
Also,
immediately.
Here's another, this is another tangent, but I think an important one. I received through message on PlayStation 3 today from Steve Power, news that The 13th Warrior will be on Blu-ray in October.
Yes, I think we talked about that, didn't we?
An important objection.
That is an important announcement. Didn't we talk about that theme too, Clark? That's a Goldsmith theme, right?
It is, and a great score, really.
It is. Very good, yeah. Really.
So save your pennies now.
When is it coming out?
October.
Oh. Is that getting like a Region 1 release? Because I saw something about it coming out in France.
It's out in Germany. It's out in Germany right now.
Okay.
Wow, long overdue. Wow, that's excellent news. Only eclipsed by the Blu-ray release of Sudden Death, but again... Yeah. Yeah, we could only hope. So,
one of those $6.99 catalog title releases in the future somewhere.
That's right.
And I would like to see a Blu-ray release of Psycho Kickboxer, just so that I could see the bands of wear from the VHS that they dubbed it from. You know,
Clark, are you familiar at all with Psycho Kickboxer, Clark?
I am, partially thanks to you guys.
Okay, there you go. I don't know what the themes are there. I'm pretty sure they're terrible. So,
well, there is that rap.
There's the Psycho Kickboxer rap at the end. So again, if you want an extra credit, Clark, there you go. Seek that out. I think you dropped it cool at $4 on your copy then?
Yes. I think it was like $6 including shipping. No, it was under $5, including shipping.
So these gems can be had. So, all right. Well, I guess we're going to transition to you, Clark, where you'll have some of these selections, right, for our listeners' enjoyment.
Absolutely.
Excellent. So thanks for agreeing to do this. A lot of fun. We'll definitely do this again in the future, and hopefully we'll be able to talk about the wonders of Sudden Death and Psycho Kickboxer when we reunite.
I am very much looking forward to it.
And Dan, what else do we have to say?
Thanks. 10 points easy.
All right, we continue now with our thrilling crossover edition of The Sounds and Sights of Cinema and Objection by spotlighting some of the film scores we've been talking about on the program, and we'll begin with a score co-written by Hans Zimmer, Nick Glennie-Smith, and Harry Gregson-Williams for Michael Bay's The Rock. Enjoy. music written for The Rock. The main thematic idea is written by Hans Zimmer, but most of the actual underscore written by Nick Glennie-Smith, and Harry Gregson-Williams contributed a bit to that as well. Next up, we move along to Mr. John Debney and his score for the aforementioned Sudden Death. music by John Debney, written for Sudden Death. Earlier in the program, we talked about Trevor Jones and his broad, expansive theme for the Sylvester Stallone thriller Cliffhanger. Let's take a listen to that piece. The main theme from Cliffhanger by Trevor Jones. We were also talking about the Under Siege movies earlier in the program. Now, the first Under Siege score was written by a guy named Gary Chang, and it was a very synthesized effort, kind of a low-budget sounding score. Actually, the score for the second film, Under Siege 2, is bigger and beefier and written by a more high-profile composer, Basil Poledouris. And it's not bad stuff. Let's take a listen to some of it now.
Thank you.
That's the main theme from Under Siege 2, Dark Territory by Basil Poledouris. Next up on tap, we have Mr. Jerry Goldsmith with his distinctive theme for Air Force One. We'll be right back. That's music written by Jerry Goldsmith for the film Air Force One. I do hope you've enjoyed the program today. A bit of a different show for the Sounds and Sights of Cinema, and I'm sure for Objection as well. And we will return to our normal programming schedule next week, but I do hope you've enjoyed this change of pace we've had to offer. And we close things out with a score from another film that owes quite a bit to Die Hard. This is Michael Kamen's music for Die Hard 2, Die Harder. Have a great week, everyone. Back at you later. Thank you.